Let's talk about setting priorities and objectives for these times of change and uncertainty. Paul, these are certainly times of great uncertainty and stress, and I think that, and I think you probably would agree, that during the next 24 to 36 months, we're going to be, again, as we said in a previous tape, on some very uncertain waters, uncharted seas. Most of us have never been this way before. It's going to take some tremendous thinking, planning, developing, and recognizing the times and being flexible enough to change during these particular times. Everything that we're going to be saying and talking about tonight will not apply to everyone listening. Several factors will be involved. Your age would certainly be one of the factors involved. If you're very young and in business and have very little capital to lose, you would want to ignore some of the things we're going to talk about when we say be conservative. Then on the other hand, if you are young and have quite a lot of capital in your hands that's yours, you would want to be conservative. In other words, it's going to depend on what you would have to lose at this particular age in your life. If you were middle age and pretty well had it made economically, then you certainly would want to hear everything we're going to be saying tonight about being conservative. And after all, one of the major factors in the business today is that be conservative. Doesn't only apply to business, but it also applies to the management of homes and churches and any kind of an institution that is handling funds of some kind. So, and there again, when we say be conservative, that might mean one thing to one person, and to another it might mean altogether another thing. I have, I think, Polly, you would agree that that the decisions that we've made all through the years have been basically made from the conservative side. We have always operated very, very conservatively. And I think it's been one of the key factors in the economic success that we've experienced in our lives, the fact that we have been extremely conservative in some areas. Now, it doesn't mean that because we're saying be conservative today that you're always going to live conservative. But once you have adopted a plan of operating conservatively, you're always going to weigh up to make sure that every dollar spent is going to be a productive dollar. It's going to accomplish a certain thing that you set out to accomplish it. And, of course, I feel like that a lot of that came from my father, who was a super, super money manager. And your father also, Polly, was one of the best money managers I've ever known in my life. Both of these dads have contributed to our ability to manage money and be conservative with what we've made in our lifetime. But as I said earlier, what might seem to be conservative in the eyes of one individual might not be considered to be conservative to another. So I want to define what we're talking about. So let me just suggest that in your business today, whatever business you're involved in, let me suggest that you make do with what you have. Don't spend any money unless it is absolutely necessary. Now, we've always operated that way, Polly. We never, basically, I'll say, and certainly for many years, for over 20 years in our life, we've certainly done that in every area of our life, but in most areas of our life, we've done it ever since we have been married. And so this is just a key, it's a principle, and many people, when they start in business and then they begin to make a little money, they feel like that money is designed to be spent to buy all the gadgets, a bigger home, a bigger car, live a more affluent life. And they've never learned that the money is actually a tool, like you would use a tractor or a forklift or a front loader or a truck or a pickup or an automobile. The capital, the working capital, is just that. It's another tool, and it is probably the most essential tool to our lives. And that's just a fact that every one of us need to get a hold of. Unless we can learn the value of a dollar and what it can do and how essential it is, we're never going to make it in business. There are people who can make money and do quite well at making money, but quite often many of those people are not able to manage the money after they've made it. Polly?
Perry, I was thinking that I've noticed through the years, when individuals began to make a little bit of money, have a little bit left over, the net profit is beginning to show up a little bit in the bank account, the very first thing they want to do is to go buy something new. They feel like that they have waited so long that now that there's a little bit of money there, they'll go buy something new. It's real strange, Perry, that it seems like, as the old saying goes, that money begins to burn a hole in their pocket or in their bank account, and they just cannot stand that hole to be there, so they, instead of keeping a reserve, they spend it.
Exactly right. So true. So I think we'd need to suggest that in the business today, make no major non-productive purchases, such as cars, equipment, tractors, airplanes, buildings, anything that could be put off until a later date should be put off at this time. This is not the time to take a working capital, our capital reserves, and put them into equipment. Now, if there's an absolute need for a pickup or a truck or any of the equipment that's been mentioned, and there'd be thousands of other items, of course, I'm just suggesting a hypothetical situation, then if it's really needed, certainly it should be done. But the pickup may be a $2,000 pickup, and it may be doing the job, may not look as pretty. It may not shine as much, but if it'll do the job, use that vehicle and let it do the job, and don't use up the capital, because we're going to experience some mighty, mighty shortages in our capital. So we need to avoid non-productive investments unless a unique opportunity comes along, and then only the very best of terms. With surplus cash on hand or in reserve, we may be able to take opportunities or bargains that might just pass us up. But even if it's a bargain, if we don't need it, the old term, a bargain you don't need is an extravagance, is a pretty good statement. And a lot of people think, well, it was a bargain and I just bought it. And of course, I think, Polly, we'd have to say that would get back to the emotional spending that we talk about in successful money management. So we need to buy only what is necessary at a time like this.
Perry, I feel like the word necessary needs to be looked at real closely. And be sure that it is necessary, because sometimes just because we want something real bad, because we have the extra money, we can convince ourselves that it's really necessary. And anything before you buy.
I was thinking, Polly, how years ago we were kind of got caught up in it. I had grown up in a very conservative environment and had made do with everything I had. But somewhere along the way, and I suppose it must have been around 47, 49, somewhere along in there, I started buying new cars every 2 years, and it was a real mistake. Of course, it felt good. It feels good to the ego. It's the ego man that needs the new car and the new pickup and the new truck and all the new things. And if he doesn't like himself too well, doesn't feel good about himself, of course, he'll go out and buy something like this to pick himself up. And so I'm sure this was what was happening, even though I'd lived most of my life very conservatively. But I kind of got caught up in this. Our income, of course, was super good, and we felt like we could afford it, and we could, because we were not only being able to drive a new automobile and live in a real nice home back then, 3-bedroom brick home, and with all the comforts of that you'd want in life, and yet we could have been putting that money aside. Along with some other money we were putting aside for our future investment purposes. And I noticed that about the time we'd have a car about 2 years, I'd begin to find things that were going wrong. Well, seemed like maybe the brake shoes were a little bad, or maybe wheel bearings were going out, or maybe the shocks were a little bad. And about the time that the new model came out, you know, we were buying the odd year every 2 years, and 49, 51, 53, right on down through the years. And I'd start finding all these things that the car actually needed. And there were no more reasons than anything in the world. They were just an excuse to buy another automobile. Of course, in about 1960, I really began to evaluate where we were and had looked back over the past probably about 6 or 7 years where we had been buying a new car every 2 years, and realized that we had poured an awful lot of money down the drain that could never be recovered, and decided to take a more economical approach. And of course, from that day unto this day, for a family car, you know, that which has been over 22 years, we've never bought a new family car. We keep buying another used car about every 4 years, and use it up. And so our overhead on automobiles has been very low through the years compared to what it was back even in those years. So in order to for an individual to begin to hold on to the capital reserve, the working capital, he needs to be very cautious about purchases at this particular time and buy only what is absolutely necessary. Let's also talk about increasing our capital. The banking industry, Polly, as you know, because of the study you and I have been doing for a long time in the economic world, has undergone some very unusual changes. And right at this very time, bankers are scared to death. Because of a lot of facts that are happening. Of course, banks have regulations that they have to operate by, which generally limit them often to a city, but always to a state, so they're confined pretty well to a state. And at this very time, Sears and Roebuck is beginning a plan, and they've been in this study now for quite a long time, And they're beginning to offer, or going to start offering, a banking service that'll be worldwide. And they're going to make it very difficult for the banker. So the banker doesn't know what to do today, because these people are not governed by the regular banking laws. They also are going to get in. They've been in the insurance business and have done a pretty good job at that. Now then, they're getting into the real estate business, so they're going to have branch offices literally all over, well, wherever they've got offices and stores, and they're going to have a real estate office set up there. And they not only will be able to sell you the home, but they have the capital and will have access to the capital to finance it. And this is going to be a major problem. So the banks are scared to death. The bankers are scared to death today, simply because they don't know what to do in relationship to this particular area. And of course, they're going to make it tough on the realtor. The realtor has been in a relatively comfortable position over the past years. And in my personal opinion, there's probably more money in real estate. That doesn't mean that everybody can go out here and get in real estate and make a lot of money, but you know how I've always felt, and for all of our life, we've had owned real estate even before we married, and have all through the year have owned one or more pieces of real estate, which it might have been a home or two homes, or a ranch and a farm and a home, or that kind of thing. That's been a combination, chicken ranches and subdivisions and all kinds of investment properties. And I like real estate, and I personally think that in real estate there's an awful lot of money to be made. But there may be people listening to this tape who are in the real estate business, and your business is going to undergo a tremendous change, and probably over the next 10 years you might actually be experiencing such difficulty that you'll be unable to continue to stay in a privately owned real estate office. There'll be some who will have their businesses so built and reinforced that they will be able to. But you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea now to begin, if you're an innovator, to begin to look down the road about 10 years and try to decide what steps you could take that you could ward off such a blow to your own industry. You may want to consider buying into a franchise, getting into one of these branch offices that are being offered now on the market. Also, Merrill Lynch, one of the great finance organizations of the world, are also buying up some of the largest real estate firms across the country. And if they are unable to get the financing through S&L, they simply will furnish the financing themselves. So there's going to be an unusual shortage of capital during the coming years. And I think this is something that we're going to be stuck with for many, many years into the future. So it's something that every businessman needs to give some very careful thought to. There's some things that have caused us to have a real shortage in our capital. And let's just talk about them for a little bit, Polly. I think one of the things is the what we'd call the undeveloped nations of the world, who now have created and have developed a real thirst for capital. Nations that have never had very much affluency. They don't have many of the gadgets that most Americans have in their homes. Now then, the large companies have recognized there's a tremendous market out there, and so they're now marketing items that will go into these various homes and huts, we could say, literally all over the world. These are undeveloped nations, and it is creating a tremendous shortage of capital in our world today. And then, of course, there's the massive debt of the federal government that has to be financed, and that too is going to take up large chunks of the surplus capital. Of course, they could run off some more paper money. But each time that happens, of course, it only affects our inflation that much more. And so our dollar, each time a dollar's run off what is known as the paper economy, then our dollar reduces in value each time that happens. So, of course, that's not the solution to the problem that we're facing today. And another factor involved that's going to be a major factor is going to be our great need for housing. This is something you and I have been pretty conscious of, Polly, because we've been involved in some tremendous extensive research in the area of multifamily living and are aware of the great housing need all over the world today. And right now, Polly, the most recent survey shows that over the next 8 years, there actually will need to be, there will be 17 million new families that will need homes. That'll be added to our world. There will be 17 million new families in the next 8 year period of time. That means there's 17 million new homes needed for those families. But because the many homes that are they're gone, that will need to just be burned down, or I mean really destroyed some way with a bulldozer, or if they're condemned, they may burn them down, and depending on where they are. So the overall need for housing in the United States in the next 8 years is 22 million homes. That's lots of homes, Polly. Can you imagine what that's going to do to our economy? That's going to take billions and billions of dollars just to finance that. Now, because of the high interest rate now, and probably is going to get higher, more than likely, in many cases, there will be two families living in many of the houses across America. A total new lifestyle that our world is beginning and going to be experiencing over the coming years. So since there are many other things, Polly, that we could talk about extensively in this area of the economy and the shortage of capital today, there's not going to be money available. We said on a previous tape in this particular same series that while in 1940, 50% of the money was surplus and was just simply in the bank and was not doing anything except just there because depositors wanted it there. Now then, every dollar is stretched to its fullest operating capacity, being stretched thinner and working harder than it has ever worked because of the tremendous shortage. Now, if we can envision that happening, we can begin to see in a 5 or 10 year period down the road that there's going to be very little capital available to us through others. So the key to that, Polly, is that we each one develop our own capital reserve. In a small business, you simply don't live up the profits. I can remember that we've been in business because primarily, all through our life, you know, Polly, we've been associated with some kind of business until the last, probably since the mid-70s. We've not been involved in any business during that time. But previously to that, we've been in many different kinds of business. Been in the real estate business. We've been in the construction business. Deeply involved in all kinds of building business, in the development business, developing small tracts of land into housing areas and then putting together packages such as shopping centers and apartment projects. And so our studies and our expertise, it just spreads through an awful lot of these areas. But in our business, all through the years, darling, you're aware of the fact that we have been very careful, and we've taken only what money we needed to live on in most cases, and then we have taken some of the balance of that reserve and have used it for investments all through the years. But in many small businesses, most people think that if they begin to make a lot of money, they just live it up. They move into bigger houses, they drive bigger automobiles, they just are supposed to live that up. They're supposed to use up the surplus. But that individual, of course, will never succeed. And for those of you that may be listening by tape, you'll have to be very cautious about this. And this will be something that the two of you, you and your mate, will need to begin to sit down and communicate about. Because I don't believe that any decision is the best decision if it's only reached by one person. I believe it's going to have to be decided upon by both husband and wife if it's going to be an excellent decision. And this is something that I think every couple ought to evaluate and ought to look at and decide what to do. But it is absolutely unthinkable that an individual live up the profits of that particular business at that time. That money needs to be put back and put into a reserve to where it is actually earning money. There are two ways to make money. One of them is you work for it, and another you actually let money work for you. As you prosper and as you get bigger, everything will be contending with you to buy me. All the new gadgets, all the things that is being offered by the media today, and ever news media, Polly, today is designed, and I'm sure not putting them down because they've caused us to know about products we probably otherwise would not know about. But they're all designed to cause us to want what we do not have. You agree with that?
Yes, I do, Perry. And I was just sitting here thinking as you were talking that I feel like one of the dangers of a small business when it begins to prosper is that people do not know how to curb their desire for things. And as you said, they eat up the profit before the profit can ever build up so that they're out of danger. And it's tragic. But I think it's so many times it's because they have never stopped to think. They're enjoying a taste of success. And therefore, it feels good to be able to have a few extra dollars to go down and buy something that maybe they've wanted or they see that looks good. And so there's just a good feeling. It lifts you up. As you said a little while ago, so many times when we bought new cars, it was to build our ego at that moment. But we need to stop and realize the need of having some cash reserve on hand.
I guess that would be about the same as a farmer eating up his seed corn, wouldn't it?
It sure would.
You know, if a farmer grew his crop and you know, having come from a background on the farm and ranch, Dad, of course, never was much of a row crop farmer, but Dad loved cattle and has always had land generally in his lifetime, and it would be like Dad deciding that we were going to just eat up all the corn. I never will forget, as a boy, as we would get the corn for the horses and for the hogs, if we had hogs, and sometimes we did. Well, Dad would say, "Now, boys, as you're gathering and as you're selecting the corn to feed the horses, I want you to throw the best ears over in that seed box, because that's what we're going to plant next year." And so using up the money that might be left over, usually, would be like Dad saying, well, we've used up that. We're just going to go ahead and eat up all the seed corn. And if we'd have done that, there'd have been no crop to plant the next year. This decade, of course, will be marked with increased shortages of capital. High interest rates, volatile and uncertain availability of credit, and a radical changing world. We're moving, as we've already said, into uncharted waters. So there must be a way that we can actually increase our working capital to a level that will create a smooth flow of production and provide a safety net and a compensating balance. As we provide this safety net and a competitive edge, we can do that by maintaining a good working relationship, of course, with savings and loans, with banks. And I think that we'd suggest, Polly, that an individual actually have more than one bank. Now, to start out with, if you're a very young business person, you probably will be required. You probably will have to leave all your business in one particular bank. You probably won't have enough to spread it around. But the time will actually come when, because of their limitations to lend you, you'll have to diversify that, and you'll have to get involved in more than one bank, or otherwise they'll be unable to provide the necessary funds. This is one of the reasons that it's a fairly good idea, and I know this has been a concern of ours from time to time, Polly, that we're with a bank that has a good, strong deposit of capital on hand. And then, of course, this is what limits them. If they have a small amount of money on deposit, then, of course, they can only loan a small amount. They'll be governed by the amount of money that they actually have on deposit as to what they can lend you. And for a number of years after buying the ranch in Arkansas, where we moved in about 1970, we did operate out of a fairly small bank, but during those times, much of our investment was relatively small, and there was not the great need for a large bank. Later on, of course, we begin to deal with banks who were in a better position to make stronger loans than the bank that we'd been with for all that lengthy period of time. When we're talking about a compensating balance, we're talking about the operating capital, the cash reserve, and these are just a few of the things that that banks are going to begin to really require as we begin to venture out and begin to expand our businesses at a new level. Great opportunities present themselves in times of great crisis. To take advantage of them, we'll have to possess three things: the capital and the knowledge and the courage. The courage to act at a time like that. We should increase our lines of credit to provide investment and growth capital and working and marketing capital. There are several things we should do to secure relationships with financial institutions. I'd like to talk about them for just a little bit. Here are some things that a banker actually would look for. If you're going to talk to the bank about a line of credit, you need to understand what the banker's looking for. If you know what the banker's looking for, and then we'll, of course, provide him with what he needs, you will begin to develop and build a relationship with him or with the institution that he represents. here are some things that I think you ought to look for, at least three things that I think you ought to provide for him when you need more money. Number one, you need to maintain compensating balances. In other words, you need to have cash on hand. One of the very first things that any bank is going to look for is the amount of money that you have on hand. In fact, the amount of money he's going to loan you is going to be determined largely by the amount of money that you have on hand. Also, another factor is going to be that he's going to punch the computer button. He's going to find out what your balance has been on an average throughout the past working year. The larger that compensating balance actually is, the more favorably he's going to view the loan that you're going to ask him for. It's important that you maintain that. The banker wants to lend you money. That's the only way he can make his money, but he wants to loan that money to you and then go home and crawl into bed and be able to sleep all night long without wondering if he's going to get his money when the due date comes, because after all, he literally is not handling his own money. And he might worry more if he were, but he's handling other people's money, and therefore it must be operated, and he must manage it very carefully. For example, a building contractor that does not have a compensating balance, that does not have a cash reserve, may in times of, well, any kind of times, whether it is a good time of building or construction, or whether it's a struggling time. Building contractors normally say it's either feast or famine. If that building contractor does not have a cash reserve, he's going to be always struggling with the bid and trying to do it too cheap in order to get the job, because he's depending on an income. Whereas, if he has a good, strong cash reserve, he doesn't have to get every job that comes along. He doesn't have to underbid everybody. And it's important that an individual has the kind of cash reserve that he's not forced to have to get every job. One of the things we learned, and I'll never forget, years ago, we were building a building for the a congregation of people in Odessa, Texas. The contractor that I was working for at that time, I was in my early 20s. I was foreman on the job. And the man that I was working for, when I asked him if he got a certain job he was bidding that day, he said, no, he didn't. He said, I learned a long time ago that it's not the jobs you miss that bankrupt you. I've never forgotten that, Polly. And all through the years when I've missed a job, I felt like, that wasn't the end of the world. And we never did find ourselves in the place to where we had to have every job. Because if you feel you have to have every job to make it, you're gonna cut and trim the margin of profit right down to the bottom line, and then if something doesn't turn out like you've planned it, you're going to wind up not making the profit that you otherwise should have. So it's going to create some real problems for you as you go along. The next thing we need to offer the banker that he's going to be looking for is a good, strong track record. You must build a track record. Now, those of you who are young and have not already established a track record, you'll just have to start from right where you are, and you'll be limited on what you'll be able to borrow, but everybody is when they start out, unless they have an awful lot of cash on hand. But as you begin to move forward, you'll need to be aware of the fact that your track record, that your reputation, that the tracks you leave are going to be the strong factors in the future of you being able to borrow money and to have a good line of credit. It's got to be in harmony with what they want, with what they're looking for, if it's going to meet the need for them. The third thing, you'll need to establish yourself as a leader in your particular field. Bankers like to deal with leaders, Polly. I'll tell you, when they realize they've got a leader, when they realize they've got a man who's a success, there's no limit to what a banker will do once they establish or find out that you're a leader in your field, and that whatever you do, they know you've done the homework or the research. They know you're knowledgeable in that particular field, and that any time you start in that direction, you're going to be able to complete it. You're going to be able to do exactly what you've told them you were going to do. And so they like to deal with successful people. There's something about that that just makes them feel good. There are people, of course, that the banker will literally avoid and will not look for at the time of loaning money. He's going to try to avoid that man as much as he possibly can. The next thing that I'd like to talk about is solidifying our relationships with financial institutions. In other words, get in solid with your bank, particularly at a time like this when we're going to be experiencing shortages of capital. There's never been a time when we needed to have good, strong, working relationships with a bank or an S&L like we do today, because there's going to be less capital available and the conditions are going to be more severe. We're going to be more complex to get it and more people bidding for the money. And that's the reason it's extremely important that we have a good track record. If we have a good, clean track record, if we've followed through with everything we told the people we were going to do, then when the time comes, there's not going to be any question about who they're going to loan money to. There's going to be an open end in our line of credit regularly if we have continued to maintain this good track record, if we've come through each time. We need to diversify our relationship with financial institutions simply because we will outgrow one bank in most cases, and so therefore we need to develop more and more sources of supply as our business expands and as it begins to grow and as we begin to reach out. Then we need to maintain financial independence. I think a word of advice here, Polly, would be don't let a bank control you. Now, in the early years of business, as I've already mentioned, one bank will probably be about all an individual will be able to handle. But after a few years of growth, one banker probably will no longer be enough, even though they'll want to control you and they'll want you to have all their business, all of your business with them. That's just not wise, simply because, as I've already said, the day will come when one bank cannot supply all that you would probably need at that particular time. And money always seeks to control. There's a spirit about money that it literally seeks to control man. And this is something that we should not allow to happen. Be sure that we maintain adequate capital reserve and develop varied relationships as we grow. The next area that I think we ought to talk about is the area of staying lean. This is something we've already talked about a little bit, but I feel like for the next 2 or 3 years, every business should determine and make one of their goals to stay extremely lean. And that, of course, is simply going to mean that you're going to build strong cash reserves individually. This also means that you're going to sell marginal investments also unused equipment, equipment that you're not using, that's just sitting there. Of course, this is something Polly, you and I have always done. You know, if I've got a piece of machinery sitting around that I don't have any use for, you know me well enough that I'm fixing to find a market for it and take that money and put it where it's going to earn money or where it's going to be productive. It's going to do something. I remember many times over the past, even the past 10 or 12 years, that there'd be some back there years ago. We were in the bulldozing business, had a couple of bulldozers, and bought the first one, of course, to clear land here on the ranch and open up pasture land and develop a cattle operation. And we had several fuel tanks. One was a mobile tank that I pulled around wherever the second dozer was working at. And then we bought a stationary tank that we had here at the house. But after we got rid of both those dozers, probably in the mid-70s, I didn't feel the need of having a fuel tank. And even though it probably would have come in handy a time or two, I found out that I could get a few $100 for that fuel tank. And so I put the word out that I had one for sale and sold it. So I think it's extremely healthy, though, for an individual today with the shortage of cash, that we make every dollar work as hard as we possibly can. Also, non-productive assets, anything that's just not producing, we need to do something about moving it, putting in something that is producing, something's growing. With inflation as it is today, money, if it's not working and earning, money is actually shrinking, no matter what it's in, unless it's in an appreciating investment or properties or something that is growing in value. We also need to make cash work harder, lower non-interest-bearing checking accounts, but not reserves. Borrow only as much money as is necessary, and consider open-end lines of credit. Let's talk about making cash work harder than it's ever worked before. And that's one of the areas we've been just kind of talking about for a few moments. That is that we need to stretch the dollar as far as we possibly can. In our working capital, we only need to keep enough to operate. Maybe that's for a two-week period or a month period. But we don't want to keep a lot of money in that working account, because it's a non-interest-bearing account, and so consequently it's not going to, it doesn't need to be large. And a bank doesn't require you to have a large amount of money in that non-interest-bearing account. They'll allow you to take large sums of money, put them into interest-bearing accounts, and they're there where you can draw them out and transfer them into your regular working account at any time you actually need to. In borrowing money, be sure that just because there's extra money that's available to you, that you don't just borrow that money. It's just not wise. But it's always wise to consider open-end lines of credit. In other words, if you're going to need, just say you're going to need $75,000 for this particular year to operate on during the year, then the ideal way to do that, maybe you have $20,000 in cash reserves on an interest-bearing loan somewhere in the bank or the savings loan, you simply would make arrangements with the bank to borrow $75,000 and would sign a note for $75,000, which would tie up or tie the bank to you with an open-ended note. Then say, for example, the first month you needed $25,000. You have mailed your invoices and you've spent quite a bit of money that month, but you need $25,000. You simply call the bank and tell them, I'm writing a check now and it's going to amount to about $25,000, and they'll simply transfer that into your working capital, $25,000. Then say in the next few days you get $15,000 back. Somebody just paid you. You take that $15,000 down and apply that to the $25,000, because you're actually only going to be charged for the money you use for the length of days that you actually use it. So it's vitally important that we have this open-ended note that's always there. Then if we need more money, we don't have to go back to the banker and say, I need another $10,000 or I need another $20,000. We've got an open-ended line of credit which just makes available to us up to $75,000. Now, we ought to always make that note big enough to the best of our ability that it's going to handle us through the year. And when we need it, then feel free to use it. Only use it if it's absolutely necessary. Never use it, of course, just for our own interest. We need to, for our own selfish needs. We need to also avoid marginal projects, also products, and those with low returns and high risk. Always stay away from that kind of a situation. I think another thing, we need to maintain a moderate volume of business. Many businesses have felt like that I'm not making any money if I can just do a larger volume of business. Boy, I'm going to make it. But a larger volume of business, anytime you start producing a larger volume of business, productivity is going to drop. Paula, you remember back in many years we were in the masonry construction business, and I did an awful lot of masonry construction, and a lot of guys were saying, listen, you need to build the business big. We'd find that on any given crew, that you put more than about five men on the job, actually put more than four men on the job, production would immediately begin to fall. First of all, if you've got about four men on a job, just an average, fairly small job, the foreman will still be able to lay brick and block and work with his tools right along with the other men. But you start putting five or six or up to ten men, first thing you know, then the foreman is not going to be as productive. He's also not going to be there to kind of set the pace. And consequently, the job begins to decline, it begins to drag, and the profit begins to fall at an unbelievable pace at that particular time. So, we try to do specialized work and avoid some jobs, yet we were looking at specialized jobs that would offer the highest profits at a particular time. And so doing a moderate amount of business actually will increase the profits rather than trying to do an unbelievable amount. Of course, in our overall business, Polly, through the latter part of the 60s, we were just a small business, but we were running something like about 30 employees on the payroll. But we, in that, would probably have five or six or seven jobs, most of which would be fairly small. We'd normally have maybe one school building going or one large project going, and we'd have the more competent people in charge of leadership and foremans on those jobs, and then the less competent people on some of the other jobs. And there's been several times, we've had a large office building going and maybe a school project going at the same time. But generally, we were keeping two or three men on a particular job, just a small job, but they were all able to maintain a good profit on a daily basis. And, of course, if you remember, we always required that each foreman would present, right along with his time, the amount of material that was laid that day in the wall, right along with the hours. And so any time that we came home in the evening, now I think this is vitally important. Records are extremely important. And you could talk about that much better than I could, Polly, because you've kept the books all through the years. I'd come in and say, Polly, I need to know where we're at on this Safeway store we're building. Or I need to know where we're at on the Shell building we're building today. And with just a few figures in the calculator, you could tell me exactly where we were, how much profit had been made, and where we were actually at that particular time and place in the midst of that particular construction project.